We're looking at the life of David. We're looking at the life of Ralph now, but we're looking at the life of David. That's where we're going to end. And we've been looking at this for several weeks, and so what I'd like to do is to read to you the passage, and then we'll go from there. We're looking at 2 Samuel chapter 16, 5 through 14. And this is a few years after the incident that developed with David and Bathsheba, where he's confronted by the prophet that we read about last week. So beginning in verse 5, "And when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family, the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continuously as he came, and he threw stones at David and at all his servants and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on the left. Also Shimei said, thus when he cursed, 'Come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered the kingdom to the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you are a bloodthirsty man.' Then Abishai, the son of Zariah, said to the king, 'Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please let me go over and take off his head.' But the king said, 'What have I to do with you, you sons of Zariah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, "Curse David." Who then shall say, "Why have you done so?" And David said to Abishai and all his servants, "See how my son who came from my own body seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered it. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day." And as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed at him, threw stones at him, and kicked up dust. Now the king and all of his people who were with him became weary, so they refreshed themselves there." Amen. It's often said that life is like a journey, that life is like a road, really. But then the question is, what kind of road is life like? I mean, if you think of life as us traveling on a road, is it like a Sunday afternoon drive where you go and it sort of goes slowly and you get to see a lot of scenery? And you make a lot of people mad who are behind you, but essentially, you drive and it's sort of slow, it takes some time to get there, and you get to see a lot of nice things in life. Or is it sort of like driving on a racetrack and you're making 300 circles or 300 loops and you're trying to beat all the people who are in the race with you and you hope to win at their expense? Is life sort of like a race? Or is life like an obstacle course where you're running and there are different kinds of struggles that ultimately you're going to face in life and you've got to get through those obstacles? There are some straight stretches, but essentially life is probably running from one obstacle to another. What kind of road, what kind of race, what kind of path is life most like? And I guess for some it's a sightseeing drive. For others, it's a race where they're out to beat everybody who's in life with them. But I think if you look at the scriptures would come closer to saying that life is more like an obstacle course where you're going from one obstacle to another. Different kinds of obstacles. They're not all the same, but there are some straight stretches. But essentially, you're moving from one obstacle, one trial, one challenge to another. But then, if that's the case, the question for us is, what should we be doing when we're in the middle of the obstacles? How then should we live if we're moving from one obstacle to another? Some of you are in places of what you might call obstacle right now. I mean, if you think of your life, you're like the guy hanging from a rope trying to get over the beam, and you're hanging there and you don't know if you're going to make it. There are things going on in your family. There are people who are saying some bad things about you. You have a lot of opposition in your life right now. Maybe you look at your checkbook and it's certainly presenting an obstacle in your life. There's a lot of different kinds of obstacles, and maybe you're in an obstacle right now. Some of you are on the straight stretch and your time's coming, but some of you are hanging by the rope right now. It seems to me that if you're there, there are two things happening. There's probably more than two, but there are two things that are happening. One is getting your attention, but the other one is probably more significant in regards to your future. When you're hanging by the rope, when you're in the middle of the obstacle, when the conflict is all around you, when people are opposed to you, and when these things are happening, the thing that you're thinking about, the first thing you're thinking about is, how am I going to get out of this? How am I going to get through this? How am I going to get over this? How am I going to make this thing go away? How am I going to get my life back to the way that it used to be? And so you tend to be really laser focused on fixing the problem at hand. But there's something else that's happening that you're not always aware of. And it's more, it's going to be more influential in how your life turns out, and that is this. In the obstacles of life, you personally are never left unchanged. You're laser focused on trying to get through or to get around the obstacle or to try to fix the problem in front of you, trying to patch together the family, however the obstacle has presented itself in your life. But when you're in the obstacle, the bigger issue that we are oftentimes blind to is that you are being changed into a different person. Obstacles, trials, pains, disappointments, failures, they all hit your life like a tornado. And a tornado does not leave you unchanged. You will be changed in the trial that you are in. You are going to come out of that trial a different kind of person than when that trial began. You are being altered at your core in one way or another. That's the nature of the obstacle, of the pain, of the disappointment. And that is going to have a longer term, that's going to have a longer reach into your future life, how your life will turn out, than fixing the obstacle itself. I have a friend, and he's been, his education is in psychiatry, and he has spent most of his life sitting around talking to people with problems and diagnosing problems and trying to help people through those issues. And he and I were sitting around, and we just sort of talking shop one day, and I don't know how we got onto this subject, but he said, you know, I've talked to a lot of men who had abusive fathers in their life. They had violent fathers. He said, I've never met a guy yet who had a violent father in his life that did not drive him to an effeminate nature or to a womanizing tendency. He said, something about violence from a father directed towards a son that moves them harshly to effeminate behaviors, or it moves them to really a womanizing personality. He said, and I think the reason for that is because when a father physically dominates a son with violence, he said either two things happen. He said either the son is being fashioned, the son is being treated in such a way that the son is essentially being trained to be submissive both physically and emotionally to a man. And it drives him into the effeminate behavior that you'll see later, because for years of his life he's being trained to be very submissive to men. And he said that plays out. Or there's anger that comes out of the son. He begins to hate his father, and he sits out in life at some point to prove to his dad that he's more of a man than he is. You just think you are a man, but I'm a bigger man than you will ever be. And he sits out to prove he's a bigger man than his father who dominated him in his youth was. And he said, ultimately, how many notches are on your bedpost play into him proving that he's a bigger man than his dad was? You think about that. There's a 10,000 different scenarios we can talk about. But pain in your life never leaves you unchanged. Comes into your life and it shakes you. The pain, the sorrows that you have come in like a tornado. And while you're trying to fix the problem, the problem, the conflict is changing you into a completely different kind of person that you may not be aware of. You are being changed in ways that maybe others see, but oftentimes you yourself cannot see. Now, this brings us to David. Because here is David in the middle of an absolute heartbreaking mess. I think I've already said it before in this series that I think I've said at a previous time that this is the greatest challenge David faced, but I'm not sure now that I read about this, because it seems like every problem David faced had its own way in which you could say it's the greatest challenge. David is being driven by his son Absalom out of the palace, out of the city of Jerusalem, and he is on the run. Absalom, his son, has rebelled. He has taken part of the kingdom, and now he is out to try to kill David. Now, again, maybe some of you have been in a case where you've had a kid absolutely rebel and want to even do you physical harm. That I can't imagine there being a much lower place in life than that, to have your own son out to kill you. It's one thing to have King Saul try to kill you, but what about your own son that you love dearly? How much worse would that be? We don't know why Absalom is trying to do this. Perhaps it was because of David's parenting. David was away a lot when Absalom was young. He was on the battlefield most of that time. When you look at the life of David, he is the man after God's own heart. But you get a sense that he wasn't really a great father. He was probably below average at best. And whether or not Absalom has resentments over that, we don't know. Maybe something happened in Absalom's youth related to his father that he blamed his father for, that left a scar that he has not yet recovered from. We just don't know what is driving Absalom. But what the Bible says is that David, who is the king in this culture, is also the Supreme Court. And ultimately, he has to try many, many cases, many, many decisions come to him. And what happens in a court of law is that somebody leaves really happy and somebody leaves really mad. And Absalom, it said, would wait outside of earshot of his father. And when the losers would come out, he would pull them aside and say things like, boy, that's too bad what happened. You know, if I had been king, that wouldn't have happened, because you got done poorly. And that should have never happened. But if I was king, I'm not king, but if I was king, that probably would have never happened to you. And so Absalom did this. And what happened is person after person, family after family, clan after clan, who had a beef with the way David had ruled against them in court, begin to find each other and begin to unite under the leadership of Absalom. And when Absalom sensed that he had the power to overthrow his father, he made his move. And so in this passage, David is on the run. He's fleeing for his life. He's with a few of his closest soldiers. He's with a few of his closest advisors. And he has been chased out of the city gate, through the Kidron Valley, up the Mount of Olives. And now as they are passing beyond the Mount of Olives, out comes this Shimei, and he begins cursing him. I want you to think about this. Here's David, and this is a trying place for him. You wonder what David's thinking. He's probably in his early 50s at this point. And if I was David, I would be saying, you know what? For 25 years nonstop, I had to fight through my 20s, through my 30s, into my early 40s. I lived on a battlefield. And just when I thought that I was settling down and I was going to have some peace and quiet, here we go again. Here we go again. That's one of the things he might have been thinking. Obviously, he's devastated that his son would do this to him, and I'm sure this has overwhelmed him. And so here he is, and here comes this guy out cursing him, and he's just not cursing him, but he's lying. He's essentially saying, God is getting even with you for all the bloodshed you caused against the house of Saul. And that's a bold-faced lie, because One thing David didn't do was shed the blood of the house of Saul. He went out of his way not to do that. He could have killed Saul. He didn't. He could have killed his family. He didn't. David went out of his way to spare Saul and his family any hardship. So he's lying. A vicious lie. And he's stoning him and he's kicking dirt at him like a manager kicks at an umpire. Have you ever been stoned? My brother and I, many, many years ago, he broke up with this girl. He's a bad breaker-upper. I rode with him to pick up his stuff. And he got to the porch and her mother was in there with her and they started stoning him and got in the car and they're throwing rocks at the car as we're driving away. That's as close as I came, getting stoned. Even with a windshield between, you didn't feel so hot. He's getting stoned. His buddy says, "You may go lop off his head. Just go kill him." And he reminds me of that scene in the Andy Griffith Show where Ernest T. Bass is raising a fuss and Briscoe Darling is there and he looks at Andy and says, "Go ahead, take a shot at him. You got a right. Do something to him. You're within your rights. Let's just kill the guy." Because the guy is just kicking him while he's down and he thinks that David is going to get killed. That's what he thinks. He thinks Absalom is going to win the war so he can say this without retribution because David isn't going to live through all this. So he's getting the last word in. And David says, "No, spare him. Leave him alone." I mean, the Lord might be behind this, and the Lord has sent him, and if we respond in a halfway decent way, the Lord might reward us. David lets it go. You think about that. Here's David in this trial. He's hanging by the rope on the obstacle course. And notice that the trial is making him softer, not harder. Point one. I only have two. The problem, and I think I've preached a lot of this at a previous time. Bear with me for the next few minutes, because I need to say this to say the other thing. The problem with problems is that they always tend to harden you. Because here's the thing. In your conflict, in your struggle, in your adversarial place, the natural default of the human heart is to self-pity. That is the natural default in difficult times. The natural default is to say, "Why me? Why would this be happening to a person like me? I can't believe they would say that after all that I've done for them. I can't believe this is happening right now, because I've been trying to live right. I can't believe this is being said about me. How could they after all I've done for them?" The natural default is self-pity. And we don't say self-pity, but the natural default is self-pity, and the self-pity leads to hardness. Cigarettes will harden your lungs. Self-pity will harden your heart. It's just that simple. And the problem with self-pity is it makes you extremely hard, and it opens up the door for you to do mean things to other people guilt-free, because it also shields the guilt. Now, when you're in the middle of the problem, you're not saying, "Boy, my heart's getting really hard." That's not what you're saying. What you're saying is, "Boy, I'm getting stronger. I'm getting tougher. I'm getting wiser. I'm not as naive as I used to be. I'm learning some lessons here." But that may all be true, but you're also getting very hard in your heart. And what that does to you is it makes you a mean person who can be mean without guilt attached to it, because it also shields the guilt in your life. Most of the evil that is done in the world is done through self-pity. Most of it comes through self-pity. Think about the first murder in the Bible, Cain. What created the murderer's heart of Cain? God accepted Abel's sacrifice, but he didn't accept mine. I can't believe God would do something like this to me. He's accept my brother, but God hasn't been fair to me. What's Cain doing? This is self-pity in Cain. And what does the self-pity do? It hardens him where he can kill his own brother. Think about King Saul, who chased David all over the place. Why would Saul be so intent on murdering David? What motivated him? Remember the parade? Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s. That's what started it. And when Saul heard those girls singing, he said, what did he do? Well, they're not singing for me. It's awful. I got everything in the world, but they're not singing for me. They're favoring David over me, and that's not right. And out of that came what? Self-pity, came a hardness of heart, and became a murderous person. Think about the greatest villain in the parables of Jesus, the prodigal son's older brother, right? Out in the field, the parable ends in a way that it should not, because now it starts with a prodigal son and it ends with a prodigal son. One son leaves the house, but the other one has left the house and won't come back either. And he's the villain because he breaks the father's heart. Why? Because nobody ever killed a fatted calf for me. I've been done wrong. This has been a terrible thing. What is that? That's self-pity, which leads to hardness, which allows him to look at his father, who has loved him more than he's ever been loved in his life, and say, I'm not going back into the house with you. You and I are finished. Think about the 20th century. How did the Nazis kill all those people? They lost a war. And when they lost the war, they sit around for 20 years crying about how they were done wrong. And after 20 years of self-pity, they rose up and declared war on the whole world. Again, I think I've used this before. Timothy Keller, I think, tells about a friend of his who decided that he was going to do something wonderful. He was going to help people in prison. And he did that for a while, and then Keller saw him, and he had quit. And Keller asked him, why did you quit your prison ministry? And he said, well, I just thought that I was going to go in there and talk to murderers and rapists and violent criminals, and they were going to be guilt-ridden, and I was going to lead them to the Lord. He said, I went in there and talked to the murderers and rapists and violent people, and he said, I thought they were going to talk about how bad they had been and how they wanted to change. He said, all they wanted to do was talk about how they were wrong when they were children. But again, and I'm sure that might not be indicative of everybody who's done a violent crime, but what he's finding out is that they were done wrong as children. They had bad childhoods. They were treated poorly. That's true. But out of that came a self-pity that caused them to do evil. In your life, the problems that come into your life, the marriage that isn't what it ought to be, the children, the parents that aren't treating you right, all of these obstacles, the natural default is to harden you. Sorry. Now again, you're not saying harden, you're saying I'm getting strong, I'm getting wise. No, you're getting hard. Out of that hardness, you're going to be doing some things and not even be aware you're doing it that are quite frankly evil, but you're not going to have any guilt attached to that because the self-pity is, listen, when self-pity gets in there, essentially what you do is you can do wrong, but you can say they had it coming. After all that was done to me, I can't believe people would hold me accountable for this. Self-pity is going to hide the things that you're doing so you don't even feel guilty about it. You're turning into a very hard, destructive person and you can't see it. But look at David. It's not hardening him. It's softening him. It's not creating anger in his life, but it's creating acceptance in his life. Here he is in this very difficult place, and he's being pursued. And here's a guy that came out. And if you go back 20 years into the life of David, there was another guy who did that to David named Nabal. And if you remember the story, we haven't talked about it this series, but if you remember the story of Nabal, who basically insulted David, remember what David did? He had to be pulled off by his wife because he was going to go down there and kill him. And Abigail had to come and intervene on his behalf. But here he is, much the same situation. You might argue a little tougher, but there's a tenderness in David. There's a softness inside of David. It's not hardening him. The problems that he's facing are making him a tender, kinder kind of person. And again, what you're up against is either hardening you in ways that you cannot imagine, or it is tenderizing you. It's softening you. I had a friend who went through a divorce. I think I've shared about him here as well. But he went through a divorce, and his wife committed adultery on him, and ultimately she left him for her lover. And I remember talking to him. He was actually in the ministry at that time. And so it basically ended his ministry where he was at and created a mess in his life for a period of time. But I remember talking to him, and I was absolutely amazed that he had no ill will towards her. He said she had her lover, but I had my lover too. And what he was referring to was that he had become a pastor who was just consumed with pastoring, and he would work 70, 80 hours a week. And what happened out of that was he became a better person. He eventually remarried, became a much better husband, because he said, you know, she wouldn't have done what she did probably if I hadn't put my job above her, but I put the church above her. And there was a tenderness that came out of him that tenderized him. And that's what happens when you have a heart that's close to God. And so you see that in the life of David. But point two, not only does David grow more tender, but he also comes to trust God more. Now again, that's not the way problems usually work. It's really amazing here that David says, you know what, this problem, God's behind this. Very least, God let this happen. God sent him. God's letting this happen to me. This cursing, something that God could have stopped at the very least. And if we handle this okay, then maybe God will reward me at some point in the future. Who knows? But notice, he's trusting God more. And again, that is not the natural default when you're hanging by the rope on the obstacle course of life. That is not the natural default. Listen, who knows the human mind? Who knows human behavior better than anyone but God? God understands us more than anybody else. Who understands us second best? Satan does. Satan has been tempting people for 6,000 years. If he opened up a company, Tempting Incorporated, you'd buy stock in it because it's always going up. He's really good at it. You know what Satan believes? You know what this great psychiatrist, this great human behavioralist believes about humankind? Look at Job. He comes to God and he says, listen, Job only serves you because you bless him. If you take from him what you have given him, if you put him on the obstacle course, if you bring sorrow into his life, if you bring pain into his life, if you bring loss into his life, he won't trust you. He'll curse you. And Job is speaking from experience, because that tends to be what happens with humans when life turns against them. It's easy to trust, but what Satan is saying is this. Take the girl. Take her. She really wants to be married, but she is the last person in her circle of friends to be married. They're all married, and she doesn't have a boyfriend. See if she still trusts you and believes you have a plan for her life and remains pure to you. Squeeze her heart. It's easy for her to trust you when she's 18 and there's always boys around, but let her be 30 and she really wants to have kids and there's not a guy in sight. See if she trusts you then. If she trusts you. I mean, it's really easy to trust when your marriage is going just fine, but let that person who you thought you would spend the rest of your life with insinuate that he wants out of the marriage. Let the family start to fall apart and see if you are as committed to God's plan for your life as you were when everything was going well. Take the guy whose finances have gone well. Take the guy who has done quite well in life, and he's in a nice position, and he's got a great office. Lay him off. Let the companies that he owns in his portfolio take a great dip. Put him on the edge financially and see if he still trusts you with his money. Take that individual who's a fine, upstanding Christian, and will tell people you need to forgive and forget and bring something into their life that is really hard to forgive, and see if they are still walking around saying, God has called me to forgive and I'm going to forgive. Vengeance is his, saith the Lord. What Satan knows is that the human default in life is that when the pain, the trial comes, you trust God less, not more. But here's David again. And he's saying, I'm going to trust the Lord. Even with this problem, I'm going to trust him. And by the way, how do you trust him? Where does David's ironclad faith come from? It comes from his saying, doesn't it? He says, listen, God's behind the bad as well as he's behind the good. I think the Lord sent that guy. It's when you look at life and you say, listen, God's always there. God always sees. And God brings the good into my life, but he can also bring the bad. And it's intended to test me. It's intended to shape me. It's intended to mold me. And so I'm going to trust him because he is doing something in my life, even though I don't understand it. But he is still there. He has not abandoned me when the going it gets tough. Reminds me of what Job said. Remember Job's bitter, bitter losses. He says, but he knows the way I take. And when he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. What's Job saying? He said, the Lord sees me. The Lord hadn't forgotten about me. Life has turned against me. It's been horrible. I've had to deal with the loss of everything that I hold dear in my life. But he knows my way. He sees. And this is part of his testing that has come into my life. And when I come through this, I'm going to come forth as gold. I'm going to come forth as something far more precious, far more valuable than I am today. It's just interesting here that David is softer, he's more tender, and he's more trusting when the average person would be far harder and far less trusting in the same situation. I read a story a while back about this guy, and I love the story of his wife had this cat. And he hated the cat. He hated Fluffy, just despised Fluffy. And his wife went away on vacation, and he saw it as an opportunity to take care of Fluffy. And so his wife was gone, and he got Fluffy, put him in a bag, put some rocks in the bag, put him in the river. He murdered Fluffy. Wife comes back, and he comes clean with her. He says, you know, honey, I opened the door. The cat got out this morning. I don't know where he is. I've been looking for him, but I can't find him. But I hope he comes back. And she's very tearful. I mean, she loves Fluffy more than she loves her husband. They look for Fluffy together, and she's just broken up. And Fluffy doesn't come home, of course. Next morning, the husband says, you know what? It's hard for you to believe, but I love that cat as much as you love that cat. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to go down to the newspaper. I'm going to put an ad in the paper for information leading for the return of Fluffy. And out of my own money, I'll put a reward of $500 for information leading to the recovery of Fluffy. And nobody finds Fluffy. And a few days pass, and the husband said, you know, I love that cat. I know you love that cat. I love that cat. I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to put an ad in the paper, and we're going to raise it to $1,000 for information leading to the recovery of Fluffy. And he was out in town a little after that, and his friend who had read his ad in the paper said, are you nuts? There's not a cat alive. There's not a cat alive that's worth $1,000. Are you crazy? The man said, well, when you know what I know, you can afford to be generous. Let's see. Yeah. I can use that punchline. When you know what we know, you can stay tender. When you know what we know, you can trust. When you know what David knew, that God sees me as much when I'm hanging on the ropes as when I'm running the straight stretches. God sees, He understands, this has been brought into my life, He has allowed it to come into my life, or He has brought it into my life to test me, to try me, and on the other side of this, as Job said, I will come forth as gold. If I hang in there, if I trust, if I don't allow this to harden me, if I stay tender, if I stay pure, if I stick with God, He's going to stick with me. And the day is coming when I'll be through this and I'll be the better for it, not the worst for it. When you know what we know, you can trust. Amen. Will you stand with me?